From Genetic Engineering and Biotechnology News, this is the GenCast Network. Bringing you compelling and in-depth interviews with the biotech industry's leading researchers, newsmakers, and thought leaders. This week on the GenCast Network. Gen's Editor-in-Chief John Sterling interviews Glenn Giovannetti from Ernst & Young about current global bioindustry trends.
Glenn Giovannetti is leader of the global biotechnology sector at Ernst & Young. He's assisted biotech clients in numerous deals, including IPOs, public and private debt offerings, technology licensing and R&D contracts, and acquisitions. Giovannetti also is principal author of Beyond Borders, 2007, Ernst & Young's Global Biotechnology Report. Glenn, in Beyond Borders 2007, you report that virtually every global bioindustry performance indicator demonstrated robust growth in 2006. Would you provide some specific examples that clearly illustrate this growth?
Sure. I mean, I think they fall into a couple of categories. One is pure financial performance of the companies, in particular the public companies, but across the industry we saw, and across the globe, we saw revenue crossed the $70 billion threshold for the first time ever. That number is about $56 billion in the United States. And both of those increases represent double-digit percentage increases in revenue. Europe and Canada also saw strong double-digit revenue increases, so the revenue picture was very strong. We also saw improved performance on the bottom line with progress towards being profitable in the aggregate, the industry being profitable in the aggregate. And it takes a little bit of look below the surface a little bit to fully appreciate that, especially in the United States, where the net loss of the public companies actually widened a bit to $3.6 billion. And so it seems a little counterintuitive we say that the bottom line improved. But within that 3.6, there's a couple of numbers embedded in there that are worth mentioning. The first is that this was an extraordinary deal year with lots of M&A activity, and to the extent biotech companies were on the purchasing side of those transactions, they were the acquirer, they often took significant charges to their P&L for in-process research and development, the value of the R&D that is ongoing in the company they purchased, to the tune of in excess of $4 billion this past year. And this was also the first year that stock options were required to be expensed in financial statements, and that number exceeded $3 billion. In fact, I think it exceeded $3.5 billion. So you're looking at some fairly good-sized charges that may repeat, but in the case of stock options, are brand new, a brand new rule, and in the terms of M&A, were quite large by historical measures. That totaled over $7 billion. So a pretty healthy profit picture in the U.S. and improving profitability around the world. Outside the financials, fundraising was very strong. The U.S. Raised $20 billion in the industry in the form of venture capital and public offerings. Those follow-on in public offerings, those could include privately arranged transactions. $20 billion is the highest number we've seen since 2000, which was often referred to as the genomics bubble, where there was just a tremendous amount of IPO and other financing activities, and the number that year approached $40 billion. But 20 is certainly the strongest since then, and if you remove 2000, it's double the trend of any year before then as well. So very strong on the fundraising side. So between financial performance and capital coming into the industry, we think it was a very robust year overall.
Now, in one section, the report called 2006 the year of the deal, and this was seen as remarkable because there was no single mega deal, as was the case in the past. What changed regarding biotech deal making in 2006?
You're quite right. We are calling it the year of the deal just because of the significant number of transactions, and overall, the value of M&A transactions was up 17%. You're quite right. We pointed out that while it might have been the year of the deal, there was no single deal of the year. In the past, when we've seen these kinds of M&A transaction values, in the aggregate, there's always been one significant transaction. You know, for example, Amgen bought Immunex a few years back that drove those totals. This year, we just saw a broad number of transactions of a significant value, $500 million and above, several up above a billion. In driving that, there's really a couple of different issues there. One is the appetite, in particular, on the part of big pharma companies to continue to access technologies and, in particular, products and late-stage product candidates from the biotech industry in order to replenish their pipelines. The pharma companies are faced, as an industry, with losing an awful lot of revenue to products coming off patent in the coming years, and so they're looking to access a piece of their future pipeline from the biotech industry, and that's fueling a lot of these transactions and a lot of the competition for the transactions. And then both from the pharma side and biotech to biotech mergers, we saw an increase in acquisitions of early stage technology platform companies as both bigger biotech as well as pharma seek to, again, replenish their pipeline, but really looking at the next generation of platforms that could be, developing products the next generation of platforms that will produce many product candidates. So it's both buying approved products for more immediate replenishment of revenue on the part of big pharma as well as accessing platforms for future pipeline growth.
Now, how did the United States biotech industry fare in 2006, and what really stood out in terms of important U.S. bioindustry developments?
Well, again, as I mentioned, the performance of the industry, both in terms of revenue growth and the march towards profitability, was quite impressive. And when you look at both of those numbers, and maybe I'll just focus on revenue for a second, in the past, the story there, when we look at the aggregate industry, has often been the story of Genentech and Amgen and perhaps one or two other companies that really made up a disproportionate share of the total revenue and the revenue growth in any one year. What we've seen in recent years, and certainly in 2006, is there's a spreading situation of spreading success. We have a lot of companies now that have launched first, second, sometimes even third products into the marketplace that are driving a lot of the revenue growth. So companies, for example, such as Gilead Sciences, which saw a 49% increase in revenue, Cephalon 44%, Sepracor up over 30%, Celgene over 50%, Amlin with their first product in the market. We're seeing significant growth with a whole new tier of companies, which we think bodes very well for the continued health of the industry. And then again, I'd come back to fundraising. While it wasn't a particularly strong year on the IPO front, there were 20 transactions. It was a consistent year. I mean, investors are very consistent in the kinds of IPOs they are interested in. Typically, those are companies that have some proof of concept in human clinical trials. But we saw a lot of capital flow into public companies in the form of follow-on offerings, and we saw a very strong venture capital year, the third straight venture capital year that was a strong excess of $3 billion raised in the U.S.
Let's take a look at Europe. What were the key European biotech industry trends?
Well, in Europe, that we're really looking at a story of recovery here. A couple of years back, in 2003 and 2004, the revenue growth rate in Europe actually dipped to the negative. And 2005, we saw a nice recovery. It was a single-digit revenue growth percentage. And I think there was a little bit of a sentiment of holding one's breath to see, was this a sustained recovery in the industry, or was it, a one-year aberration? And pleased to report that Europe saw double-digit revenue growth this year. And very much the same situation on the fundraising side as well. It was a nice recovery in Europe last year, but this year total fundraising almost reached the $6 billion level, which was a record. And venture capital fundraising, which one could look at as an indication of the amount of the health of the private companies and the growth in the industry, hit a record as well, almost $2 billion. So the trends are very positive after a couple of years where we didn't see as much from the capital markets, and we actually, through acquisitions and other situations, saw a dip in revenue. So this year was a continuation of that trend and one that we feel is very positive.
Was anybody able to sort of pinpoint what enabled the European bioindustry to make this turnaround, as you say? In other words, how they're able to change from negative to positive?
Well, again, it's a similar story to the U.S. There are certain leading companies that have always had a significant percentage of the total revenue in Europe, the Seronos, Shires, others. But we've seen another tier of companies reach the market. Actelion in Switzerland comes to mind, for example. So, again, it's a story of a more maturing industry. Europe, in terms of the average maturity of the industry, number of products in the marketplace or in later stage of clinical trials has tended to lag the U.S. a bit. But there's been great progress in that, and the pipelines are actually quite full in terms of especially later stage phase 3 products in Europe and those awaiting approval.
Now, a number of analysts say that Asia is already becoming a significant power in the biotech world and will eventually give the U.S. a run for its money as the dominant global bioindustry player. Is this the case or not, and what is driving biotech's growth in Asia?
Yeah, certainly to this point, Asia does lag the rest of the world in terms of the development of robust biotech clusters, which has been so important in other parts of the world, especially North America and Europe. And so what we have there is a more dispersed situation where individual countries are trying to leverage their particular technology strengths. One underlying enabler, though, however, is the reform of the IP, intellectual property laws, in many countries. Now that you have real patent protection, or at least systems under which there's real patent protection for innovative drugs and other products, you have a climate that will encourage innovation. It'll also bring international competition, so there's opportunities there for Western companies as well. However, encouraging innovation is critical to the growth of the industry, and having a regime where patent and intellectual property advances, technology advances, can be protected and can provide a return for investors is very key. So while we haven't yet seen the clusters of the type that have developed in, as I said, North America and Europe, there are elements now that encourage that kind of growth. And then certainly there is no doubt about the importance of these markets as countries such as China, other countries across Asia, India, continue in their own economic development. They represent huge markets both for locally developed products as well as for global companies to sell their products. So it is a very positive story. It's hard to predict at what pace the growth will occur and whether Asia will one day surpass the U.S. or Europe in terms of size. However, it's clear that the markets will be very important. And it's also very clear that there is a lot of human capital in these markets, a lot of scientific expertise that now, if it can be harnessed around intellectual property and appropriate levels of risk capital funding, the prospects are very good.
Now, the report includes results from a survey of 400 CEOs from small, medium, and large-sized biotech companies. Were the respondents optimistic regarding future products, and will they continue to partner with the pharma companies?
Yes, absolutely. Nearly every CEO, is optimistic, expects growth, expects to hire more employees. The optimism was nearly universal, which I guess is somewhat to be expected. There's a bit of a self-selection involved there in terms of optimism. Most CEOs are optimistic about the prospects of their own companies. But on the deal front, too, we saw well over half expect to do a transaction to help bring a product to market in the next couple of years, and over two-thirds who expect to do a transaction of some type or another. It might not be around a particular product introduction, but around acquiring a technology, doing an M&A transaction, or doing an alliance. These could be both biotech to biotech deals, or, as you mentioned, a transaction with pharma. I think the dynamics, what's reflected in that survey is that the underlying dynamics in the market, the importance of the biotech industry to pharma from the standpoint of accessing innovation and new potential products for their pipeline, and the need for biotech, frankly, to access skills and global reach. Those factors aren't going to change. They will continue to be present. And, you know, we certainly expect the pace of both alliance transactions and M&A to stay very high for the foreseeable future.
Now, the report talks about growing challenges on biotech's radar screen. Will you describe these challenges?
Yeah, we very much put them into the bucket of challenges of success. The industry no longer just trades on the promise of biotechnology. We now, as we mentioned earlier, have, you know, a good number of companies that have products in the marketplace and that are quite profitable. And with that success becomes increased scrutiny. If you look in the U.S., that comes in the form of greater regulatory oversight. You know, to this point, if you are a company developing a product, you know, you're not yet in the marketplace. The FDA was the primary regulator you were concerned with. But once you have a product in the marketplace, you also have to be concerned with complying with sales and marketing regulations, with pricing and Medicare and Medicaid billing regulations. So there's a lot more scrutiny from a regulatory standpoint. And then there's the general political environment in which we have a situation where we have an aging population in the U.S. We have drugs as a product that probably the only product where average expenditures over one's lifetime increases. You know, most products cap out at some point in life, and your expenditures for whether it be you know, consumer products or travel or whatever it may be actually go down. Well, drugs actually increases over the course of one's lifespan, and you bring those two situations together, and the debate about the right way to pay for healthcare and pay for pharmaceuticals and pricing of pharmaceuticals, including biotechnology or biologics, will stay in the public debate, you know, for the foreseeable future. So these are all challenges, whether they be public policy challenges or individual company challenges, that will need to be addressed by individual companies and by the industry. But they are the challenges of success. If companies were not growing rapidly and were not introducing products that were desired by the marketplace, you know, these challenges wouldn't be relevant. So it's, in some respects, it's a sign of maturity that the industry has arrived.
Now, Glenn, if somebody wants to learn more about the Ernst & Young report, Beyond Borders, Global Biotechnology Report 2007, is there a website they can go to?
Yes, there certainly is. You can go to our website, www.ey.com/biotechnology, and by following links there, you're able to order and receive a copy of the report.
I'm John Sterling. Thanks for listening. Now we'd like your thoughts on some of the issues discussed during this week's podcast. Please go to www.genengnews.com/blog and answer the following question. What do you see as the most critical challenges facing the global biotech industry in 2007? Bye for now.
To learn more about topics discussed in this GenCast, or to listen to previous GenCasts, visit our website at www.genengnews.com. New GenCasts are posted every week, Thursday, 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. For the Gen Publishing editorial staff, I'm Jonathan Ellinghouse, saying thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in again next week to the GenCast Network.